Paperback Writer.
Author of the Week on Literary Lusts, brought to you by Radio Gorgeous.
Welcome to Radio Gorgeous, Alex Christie.
Thank you so much for having me.
We are here at what the Drones Club was based on, Buck's Club in London, for the occasion of the launch of your novel, Gutenberg's Apprentice. Tell us about the novel.
The premise of the novel is simple. It's the story of the world's first tech startup, which was really the last great media revolution before our own, which happened in the late Middle Ages in 15th century Germany, and it was the invention of printing. And the story is really a different story than the one we've grown up hearing, which is that Johannes Gutenberg invented printing, which we all know, but actually, in fact, he didn't do it by himself. It was a collaboration of three men, and I trace the story of this amazing, transformative technological revolution that they created, but also the personal story of how it really undid them at the end.
Yes. And that's a story that we know. The Gutenberg Bible. I don't know if it's, you know, one of the first things we learn when we're studying European history, when we're studying the history of the world. You know, there was the wheel, there was the cotton gin.
Yes.
You know, and then there was the printing press.
Yes.
You know.
And the printing press, I mean, the thing about the printing press is that it was the most important invention. I mean, the historians say since the wheel, but, you know, it transformed society so radically.
Revolutionary, because not only was literacy was not for everyone. I mean, the fact that we have illiterate people now is shocking, but literacy was purposely not for everyone.
Exactly. The only people who actually had books were the aristocracy, so the nobility, and the clergy. You know, and they were few, they were powerful, they ran the entire world. And I don't know what the percentages were, but, you know, probably 80% of the people could not read. And the thing that's interesting about that time, which is similar to the time that we're in, if you think about globalization, is that you had this great number of people, the great unwashed, you know, who wanted access to learning. And there was this huge hunger for learning. And there was, because economically things were, there was a lot of trade, there was this trading class, and they weren't part of the aristocracy, they were not part of the ruling class, and they were the ones who were driving the demand. So there was, if Gutenberg had not invented printing, someone else would have, because it was in the air du temps.
Yes.
And therefore, you know, paper had come from Asia, it had been in Europe for 20, 30 years. There were others, I mentioned in the book, there were other people experimenting with mechanical alphabets.
Yes. I did remember reading that. And the book is framed and it's told through the point of view of Gutenberg's sort of, I would say, what would you call Peter Schoeffer? The reluctant apprentice.
Exactly.
Because he was the adopted son.
We believe that he had a relationship with Fust that predated their activity around the Bible. And the whole problem with Gutenberg, with establishing what really happened, is that there's very little factual documentation. But at various points in the record, Fust is referred to as his foster father, and he's referred to as his adoptive son. So he was a farmer's son, and he ended up being a scribe in Paris. And he's documented there as a scribe. So clearly he ended up being drawn into this startup. You know, mm-hmm. It was a startup, and his father was financing it. He was the venture capitalist. And clearly there was some triangulation going on. You know, there was the inventor, and then there was the money man, and then there was this other young man who was a generation younger who had to enact what they wanted. And as a scribe, you know, he had all the technical capabilities to do it. And the thing that people always say that Gutenberg was a goldsmith, the fact of the matter is he could not have been a goldsmith because he was an aristocrat. He could not have followed the guild training because it was highly striated society.
Okay, let's talk about the society, because we have Gutenberg, who's he's mostly an elder. We have an irascible, tyrannical, genius, inveterate inventor. if it wasn't that, it would have been something else. He was one of those guys who has, like, you know, when they die and they have, like, 42 patents pending. You know, he was
exactly
that guy.
Right.
And Fust sees something. He has this moment. He sees Gutenberg's genius, and he's got money. He's a merchant. He's of the guild class. He wants to be a part of this next thing. He sees, you know, like any business opportunity, you see a hole in the market. He sees the hole in the market.
Exactly. And he also, I think he understood, because he sold manuscripts. He sold them all over Europe. He understood that this was a waning market also. You know, that the people who were able to commission these incredibly expensive, beautiful, illuminated manuscripts, you know, they were fewer and fewer far between. So I think as a businessman, he understood. He totally understood what
okay.
it was about.
My weekday fix? Darling, it has to be Radio Gorgeous.
So because it was a changing time, describe Mainz at that time. What was going on socially and politically at that time?
Okay. It was a very, very complicated time of great ferment, I would say. The thing to me that I always liken it to was Paris before the Revolution. And I think that helps mm-hmm. us to understand
yes.
the kind of psychological, you know, you had these layers of society. The church, and you have to understand that the people who were the clergy were also the nobility. They were one and the same. So they ran everything. They owned everything. They paid no tax. So you had this very heavy-handed feudal structure. And fundamentally, because Germany was such a trading nation, there was this growing middle class. And the middle class was tired of being exploited and wanted to be part of things. And the most
interesting... That sounds familiar.
It does. Well, there were so many parallels with writing today and then. And the thing that's interesting in terms of literacy is that this growing middle class, they were the ones, just like I think about India now, or I think about the people in the developing world, they want access
education
to knowledge.
Education equals access.
Exactly. And so the universities couldn't keep up with the demand. And I have a scene in the novel where I talk about the scribes writing as fast as they can. But, you know, the demand for learning was so acute. And it was coming from underneath, pushing up. And so, you know, the church, of course, they were incredibly corrupt. Martin Luther was right. You know, they each of them had four or five different jobs. They pulled income from wherever they could. And, you know, the middle classes were getting fed up fundamentally. And so what happened in Mainz is that it exploded shortly after the Bible was produced and in civil war. And it took another 30, 40 years for the whole thing to work out. But, you know, the Roman Catholic Church had an opportunity to reform in those years, and they didn't.
And this is what... Okay, so Peter is called back from Paris where he's a scribe. He's, you know, like anybody does going to Paris, is learning to live, you know, taste for the ladies, taste for the food, taste for the, you know, he's working at the Sorbonne. He's, you know, in with the in crowd, you know, as scribes go. but, you know, he's
we can only
life.
Imagine.
Yeah, exactly. That's rife for imagination. But he's called back, and because he is an adopted son, I felt, as an adopted person, there's an onus of gratitude and fealty and loyalty that he owes where he is, not by birth, but by it was gifted to him.
I agree.
This is the price.
I agree completely. In fact, I've read there's some wonderful historical literature about well-to-do young men of that generation. There's a scholar at Harvard who's written a lot about that period, and they had a completely different attitude. Mm-hmm. They were like out on the grand tour, and they didn't...
Laters.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Whereas Peter, I do think, you know, he was a very devout person, and I interpreted him. I mean, this is what fiction is. You interpret the personality and the... I don't know, the soul, in a way, of the person that you're writing about. You know, he did. Everything that he had, I think he must have gotten from Fust. And the thing I found really interesting is that those families in the late Middle Ages, they were more blended than our families because all the women died in childbirth.
And they had to. I mean, because also if you didn't have someone to leave it to, if your wife and child died in childbirth.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, I don't think Fust, his wife, did die. I don't think he had the expectation that he would marry again, although he'd and have another son. So this was an opportunity to mold someone in his image.
Exactly. And I think that those relationships, that's why, you know, people have all, scholars for centuries have blamed Fust and Schoeffer for kind of sticking the knife in Gutenberg's back. And I think they had a relationship which was predated the whole thing. And he felt an obligation to his father. And his father had a lot of money riding on this thing. And his father would have lost all that money, you know. And Gutenberg, you know, was, I think, this type of very brilliant, driven,
pain in the ass.
Pain in the ass, maniacal, megalomaniacal kind of character.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's who makes history.
Yes, and they come off the page as you write them as these types. We know them.
Yeah. Well, I've had people who said to me, I've had bosses like that. We've all had bosses like this.
Yes, the crazy detail-oriented genius who's, he's happy to work all night, you know, and dragging you along with him. Yeah. You know, it's his vision has to be your vision.
It had to have been like that. I mean, this is the thing, and I do have Peter meditate about this, you know, what kind of characters do you need to create this type of radical new stuff, you know, and the amount of work that it took. I mean, I can't even really imagine what it took to make this book because, you know, it was a pre-industrial age and they manufactured thousands and thousands of pieces of this metal type, you know.
And they were trying to do it in secret because they knew this was revolutionary.
Well, I'm not sure about how they felt. This is the whole question of how, try to interpret and imagine how it was, you know. I don't know if they knew it was revolutionary. I think they knew it was dangerous.
Dangerous, yes.
I think they knew that if they came out, the Archbishop would grab his piece. Because the Archbishop was the king. I mean, the Archbishop was very powerful, and he had a thug who ran his, you know, I kind of think it's kind of like the Jimmy Hoffa of the Archbishop's day.
Yes,
you know?
Because when we start the story, Mainz is shut down because the Archbishop has shut it down.
Yeah, and he could.
And punishment.
He could. Yeah. He could, and he could.
You don't want to pay my taxes?
Exactly.
Fuck me? Fuck you.
Exactly. Yeah. You're not going to...
Right on cue. Oh my God.
You're not going to get prayers. You're not going to get any kind
Nothing.
Of baptism.
Nothing.
No, he was, and I mean, people believed in God. And therefore, you know, this was, it was much worse than, you know, you can't ride the Jubilee line tonight. It was, your child is not going to go to heaven.
Yeah.
It was devastating. I think he had enormous power. And so I was trying to imagine how this invention, which we know is so huge, happened in this context. And the thing that I really enjoyed, which I think nobody has really tried to do, is to put it in context.
Yeah.
Put it in social and economic context, because it was created at a place and a time. And
yes.
It was a really interesting place and time.
Radio Gorgeous, created by women for women. RadioGorgeous.com.
One of the things a lot of people tonight here, we've been at an investor event, a lot of people are likening it to, you know, Facebook, Zuckerberg, you know, the social network. Peter was a scribe, and his way of life would, that he loved, that he owned, that he was proud of, that he saw the worth of, that he saw piety in, would go with it. And yet he has a Damascus Road moment where he believes this. There is in the book real palpable moments of like, is this a good thing or is this a bad thing? But they are religious concerns where my husband makes books, so I'm not allowed to have a Kindle, and people talk about the death of the book. But we talk about that as a culturally good thing or culturally bad thing. This was
religious. Yeah, it's very hard to liken it because of that, because they had this entire other...
They didn't have a secular life.
No.
Life was religious.
But I think that in a way it's not that different because it's about morality. I would say that it's, you know, they felt... Peter in particular, I think, my understanding of his character is that he was able to accept the printing press because it furthered the word of God. It was another way to spread the word of God. So it fit within his worldview.
Which it absolutely did.
Right.
I mean, factually.
And so the question for us today is, you know, so the Kindle and all of these other things, you know, what, I guess for me, it was more a question of what did we lose versus what did we gain?
Mm-hmm.
And that you can't stop progress, you can't stop evolution. And yet, at the same time, I'm really bothered by these tech evangelists, you know, who think that we can just throw it all out the window. And of course it's not true, because even in the printed period, even the first 100 years of print, there were still scribes.
Yeah.
They didn't die overnight.
Well, and also the Gutenberg Bible is drawn on. You know, there are the scribes, yeah. You know, and the artists were involved.
Yeah.
And we haven't done away with artists.
No, and people are really tactile. I mean, the thing I felt very strongly about the Middle Ages, I really connected to it because I love the Gothic architecture and I love Gothic art. And I felt like they had a connection to the earth that we do not have. Mm. And one of the things I feel about the physical book is that it's a tactile connection to we are animals, we are creatures, we are not completely abstract brains living in a science fiction universe, you know, and we like stuff. We like to touch stuff. We like to smell it. We like to feel it.
Because, and we really like it to be pretty.
Exactly. Exactly. Because, you know, we are aesthetic animals, you know.
Yeah.
And so I really don't think that it's going to go away that fast. I really don't think that the book is going to die. I mean, 600 years of fundamental anchoring of our culture. I just can't see it going overnight.
Follow us on Twitter, radio_gorgeous. Lots of love, darlings. Mwah.
And now I want to get to you a little bit.
Okay.
But you describe yourself as a printer first, then journalist, and now novelist.
Ah, that's very interesting. I didn't realize I had done
you
that.
You put printer first.
Yeah. Maybe to just justify how I knew so much about printing. But yes, in a way. I mean, I think I love printing. I love printing. I have a printing press in San Francisco. My grandfather was a printer. He taught me everything about handmade books. But I realized actually fairly early on that I was not that great of a printer. I'm not an artist. I'm a writer. Mm-hmm. I've always written. And so journalism has been my career. But this is why this book has done such a great kind of boon, because it allowed me to marry all of my different pieces of my personality.
Okay, so that's what I really wanted to ask you, is with your journalistic nose, why tell the story through fiction? What did fiction allow you to do, and what did it allow the story to do?
So the fact is there's not enough to tell it as nonfiction.
Okay.
That's the most important thing. And you know, there is this blank in history. There's a lot of detail, there's a lot of factual documented evidence, but we don't know enough to say for sure what happened. So at the same time, as a journalist, I recognized a story. I recognized a scoop when I saw it, which was, God, no one has ever told the story about the making of this incredible book. How can that be? I mean, it's incredible that no one has ever tried, but It's one of those things where, you know, you have to bring both of your skills to bear. And I wish that we could factually know exactly what happened, but we don't. And so, in a way, I think fiction, and I had been writing fiction for a long time. I got an MFA about 18 years ago now, long time ago. So I've been interested in fiction for a long time. And I just thought, okay, if I can't write a factual piece, I can write historical fiction that is really seriously based on fact.
Yes.
But that is really, you know, I'm interested in the stories behind the stories. And as a journalist, I've written, almost everything that I've written as fiction has been based on stories I've written as a journalist. And what interests me is to try to go underneath and understand the motivations of the people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, we see the snippet.
Yeah.
You know. In the paper.
We see the action.
Yeah.
But we don't actually understand where the action came from.
And it frequently comes from far, far back.
Exactly.
You know.
Exactly.
It's interesting to me to hear you say that, because it seems to marry up sort of this idea that you can look at the story in 360 degrees as well. Because there is, as you were saying earlier in your talk, there's a wealth of knowledge, and there's a heap of scholars in every aspect of this, which must have made, I mean, I understand you've answered me why you fictionalized it, but that must have made it super scary.
Totally, totally. I'm going to present it in 2 weeks to the leading scholars of early printing, but I think the thing that I've realized is that they have understood that I am a serious scholar myself. mm-hmm. and that I am interested in facts. And my interest is in trying to find, it's really just trying to imagine how it happened.
Yeah. You filling know? In the color.
It's just filling
contextualizing.
In.
Contextualizing.
Exactly. And just it, and also just, you know what happened. It's not about the what. It's always about the how mm-hmm. and the why. And why, you know, how did these people who came together to do this incredible thing, how did they end up at each other's throats? Why?
But it's isn't that also like a classic business model story?
Totally.
Totally.
Well, yeah, no, this is the thing.
You know,
it's
people's
like
expectations.
Yeah.
I mean, it never happens when a business fails, everyone just sort of walks away.
Yeah.
But when there's success, everybody wants a
piece. Exactly.
And everyone had a different expectation, a different understanding when we went into this thing.
Exactly. But this is the challenge of making a novel about it's fundamentally a business story.
Yes.
It's fundamentally the
yes.
story of a business
yes.
that came and succeeded, and then they all started fighting. You know?
And if we knew enough, we'd probably teach it at Harvard.
Yeah, yeah,
at Harvard
yeah, yeah.
Business School.
I think.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's why I mentioned The Social Network. You
yeah.
know, it's we all know this story. It's a
yes.
common story.
Yes.
But no one has ever applied what we know now to that ancient history. You know, that
yeah.
deep history, and that's the thing I found really interesting. You know, Walter Isaacson has a book out now called The Innovators, which is, lo and behold, about how all of Silicon Valley was the product of collaboration and not these lone geniuses. And I actually got in contact with him and said, hey, by the way, the world's first tech startup, same story. You know, we don't know that for a fact because everything got bombed to heck during any number of wars.
Every war since, yeah.
Exactly. But, you know, that seems to be pretty clearly the case.
Well, and as humans, we keep repeating the same cycle, so it's very likely.
Exactly.
Very likely.
Yeah.
Well, so, okay, you have apprenticed under Gutenberg yourself for 7 years, as you said, which was the time of apprenticeship in medieval times. What's next?
I am now also staying in the historical vein. I'm going to write a novel about my Scottish ancestors, who I think you have to be somewhat obsessed to stay mm-hmm. that long in a historical period. So
yes.
my ancestors emigrated from Scotland to Canada and became fur traders in the northwest of the Canadian-American okay. continent in the late 19th century and intermarried with the Native American tribes. And it's a really interesting story. It's a story about genocide, unfortunately, mm-hmm. but also, you know, these tribal structures. And I'm really fascinated, so I'm looking forward to writing that one.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Alex Christie.
It was great. Thanks so much.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production for RadioGorgeous.com. Get in contact with us. Contact us on info@RadioGorgeous.com. And to sign up for our shows to come once a week into your inbox. Who can think of anything better, darling?
Paperback writer. Paperback.
This has been a Radio Gorgeous production 2014, produced and presented by Donna Freed, edited by Bree Forer.